It's been good for me to get back and look at two of my heroes in the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha. I actually, looking over this, kind of reminded me, let me do a short series on Sunday nights back home on these two great prophets and look at some stories from their life. I want to begin by telling you about Garcia. Garcia was a notorious bandit from Mexico, and the U.S. Marshals were on his case, on his trail. He had stolen gold, and they wanted the gold back. Now, Garcia hid it, and they chanced upon him, and all he had with him was just an associate. And so the marshals want the gold. The problem is none of them speak Spanish, and so Garcia doesn't speak a word of English. There's only one person that can translate, and it's Garcia's friend there. And so they're trying to speak through him and say, Garcia, we know you've got the gold. Take us to it, and you'll be fine. We'll release you. And so the translator is telling him that, and he says, I don't have the goat. I don't know what you're talking about. And this goes back and forth, and finally they lose their patience and tell him through the translator, if you don't reveal to us where the goat is, we're going to hang you right here on the spot. And so the translator faithfully gives the words to his friend Garcia. And Garcia, frantically understanding the weight of what's happening, goes into detail about where it is. And so the marshals are looking at the friend. What did he say? What did he say? And Garcia says, or the translator says, Garcia says that he is a brave man and he is ready to die. I want to think about that translator being kind of like someone in the story maybe you hadn't thought about in 2 Kings chapter 5. Let me go this direction with you. Imagine, young ladies, that you have had your life abruptly changed for the worse. A neighboring, warring enemy has invaded your country and taken captive a lot of people, including the young folks. And here's a young lady at the mercy of the enemy who knows what type of abuses or rough treatment she'd had up to this point. And so here you are away from family, your surroundings, you're being introduced to a different culture. How would you feel? How would you react in that setting? And what we have to realize is I'm not making that up. Here's a real life, kind of an unsung hero. In this story we're going to look at, there are three named people. There's Naaman, who's kind of the focal point, the fixture of the story. You've got a reference to obviously Elisha the prophet. And then Gehazi, who is a servant of Elisha, is going to appear. But the rest of them are just, here's a wife, here's a girl, here's the king of Syria, here's the king of Israel. And so no one is named. She's not a focal point at all. But what she does is kind of like the translator, and yet kind of in the reverse way, because she's going to be a go-between, she's going to be a mediator, and serve a very important purpose for him. Let me think about my outline up there. I haven't shown you anything yet. Can we get the first slide up? Wash and be clean is where we are there in, again, 2 Kings 5. If you came in late, be sure you get back there. I'll be using the New King James Version kind of as a base text this evening, if that helps you along there. What does the story of Naaman teach us? It's what I want you to think about and want you to come to some answers by the end of the lesson. This is in the Bible for a reason. Nothing is nothing's filler material. Nothing's kind of extraneous. And so why is it in there? The answer for some would be something like this. God knew that centuries after this, that baptism would be part of the plan of salvation, and he wanted there to be a tie-in in the Old Testament so the preachers could go back and say, here's an illustration of why you ought to be baptized. Raise your hand if you've ever used the story of Naaman to illustrate the importance of obedience. I have. I'll do it again. But I don't think that this story is necessarily a prophecy. I don't think that it is a direct tie-in to it. I think it serves a wonderful purpose. So I don't apologize for that. It's just that I think there's more to this story than that. Does it teach the necessity of obedience? Of course it does. An underlying theme throughout the Bible. But as we close, we'll get even to some more, hopefully, very practical applications from the story here. In 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1, now Naaman commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor. Let me stop right there. Just three more words in that verse, but that's actually my second point. Now in Luke 4:27, before I leave this screen and get to another outline for you, Jesus referenced this story. In fact, he referenced Elisha the prophet. Here's what he says. By the way, he's in Nazareth, his hometown. And the people, after he's read from Isaiah, they're impressed by him, the gracious words that he spoke. But after these words, they want to take him out to the brow of the hill of the city and throw him off the cliff. They didn't do it, of course. But they were so enraged, incensed against Jesus and what he said and how he said it, they did it. How would he tick them off that much? These were his people. Jesus said in Luke 4:27, right after in verse 24, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. He said there were many lepers in the days of Elisha, time of Elisha the prophet. None of them was healed except Naaman the Syrian. Underline this right now. How do I know that this is a true story from the Bible? Do you believe Jesus? Would Jesus deceive us? Did he ever tell a lie? My answer to that is a quick no. Absolutely not. And so anybody Jesus referenced from the Old Testament, that includes Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham, this whole list of folks, including this story, is there to confirm, yes, this is not make-believe. This wasn't manufactured by anyone. This is real. Naaman was healed. He was a foreigner. He was healed when none of the Israelites with leprosy were. And Jesus already is opening up a window into his ministry that's going to include, ultimately, not just the Jews, but the Gentiles as well. You know, that's really good news for us. I'm looking in the face of a whole bunch of Gentiles like me, and so I'm thankful personally for that. And so in Luke 4:27, let's remember there's a New Testament confirmation of this story. Let's talk about Naaman, the great man. Look at the reference to him being a commander. Do you see that again in verse 1? He's a commander of the army of the king of Syria. Do you think they just had a lottery or kind of picked a name out of a hat? Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Hey, Naaman, you be it. No, I'm going to say he rose through the ranks and had showed his proficiency in leadership. He's a great man in regard to his occupation there. And then he's a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master. You want someone you can trust. If you are an employee still, I hope your boss looks at you in that way. I hope if you're already retired that that was characteristic of you. And so he's a great man. He's a commander. Notice that by him the Lord, that's God, had given victory to Syria. You know what Naaman reminds me of already is a lot of the Gentiles, in fact, the centurions, the Roman army officers, that in many cases were blessed because of their great faith in the Bible. And so Jesus is commending folks that you wouldn't think of as being the recipients of that type of honor, but they had distinguished themselves. Naaman was kind of their Old Testament counterpart there. He was a mighty man of valor, courageous man. And then you come to the grievous malady covered in just three verses right here, or three words in the last part of verse 1. But he was a leper. In fact, in the New King James, but a leper. Let me kind of bring this to us in a modern application. Maybe someone you know has been diagnosed with the coronavirus. Maybe it was you. Might have been a family member, friend, church member. Nearly every one of us at least has heard of someone diagnosed with corona. If it's not your family and it's not someone you have to live in the same house with, you pray for them. You might send a dish of food to them. But the one thing you don't want to be is right in close proximity. You want to go up and give them a hug, unless you're gowned and gloved, and say, man, I love you and praying for you. We understand there has to be the quarantine. That's how lepers were in the Old Testament. God made provisions in the book of Leviticus. You are isolated from the group. Here's a great man, all these things going for him. One commentator said he was as great as the world could make him, and yet the basest slave in Syria would not change skin with him. Here's the deal. You've got coronavirus, his counterpart, and there's not a respirator in Syria. It's getting bad. Here's a dead man walking. We've got to do something. Here's a guy that's about to be a casualty because of his leprosy. And so trying to identify with the dire straits that he found himself in. It wouldn't want to be us, any family member that we have, right? The gentle maid is introduced to us here. This girl, taken against her will, having to serve. And there's something remarkable about her attitude. I want you to see that. Let's read 2-4. The Syrians had gone out on raids, and he brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. And then she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy." And Naaman went and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus said the girl who is from the land of Israel." I want to commend her for doing something. She's kind of like Old Testament Joseph. That is, doing the best he can in Potiphar's household in spite of the bad treatment and all that. I want to be God's ambassador regardless of what kind of state I'm in, wherever God puts me or allows me to be. And she could have kept quiet, kind of like our translator in the original story there. And thought, "Wow, boy, he's got a bad case of leprosy. I'm glad for it too. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have to be serving his wife." And so she could have kept very silent about that. Or she could have said, "Hey, I hear there's a cure the opposite way of where we are. Tell him to go over there," and knowing full well he's going to die right there. So she tells her mistress there, the woman she's serving, Naaman's wife, "Hey, there's a prophet in Israel. I think he may do some good." Now, ask yourself a question. How did she know about Elisha? Did she know him on a personal basis? Did you remember Luke 4:27? Elisha had not been healing Israelites left and right of leprosy. There was no track record. And so there's some connection here, and she had enough concern for him that she's thinking, if he can only go there, maybe something can be done about this. Elisha is recorded in the Bible to have done about 16 to 18 different miracles, depending on how you slice them or consider them. Elijah had done right before him about half as many. And so this is one of those where it's almost Elisha is detached from the situation. He's doing it from a distance. That's unusual to me. But this girl, this gentle maid, is simply putting out there, hey, there might be some hope after all. That's our mission. We're there to say, you know what? I know life is hard for you, but you know what? There's Jesus. But tell you what, he's the disease ridder. He's the one that can remove sin from us. Simply introducing, putting him out there in the conversation is a great thing. And so Mrs. Naaman hears it. She tells Naaman. Naaman goes to the king. He may be Ben-Hadad if you go to 2 Kings 6. Not sure if that's the same one or not, but oh, okay. Look at the openness for the neighboring warring king to send Naaman, his top commander here, to the king of Israel. By the way, what did she say about the king? Nothing. Maybe Ben-Hadad thinks, well, if the prophet is there and he can heal this guy, surely that's under the authority or the jurisdiction of the king. It wasn't that way at all, though. I want you to look at the grave misconception, starting in verse 5 with me here. 2 Kings 5. The king of Syria said, "Go now and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." That's going to be Jehoram, although he's not named here. And so he departed and took 10 talents of silver. Watch this carefully with me. 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said... Jehoram is shaking in his sandals here. "Now be advised when this letter comes to you that I've sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy." Before we go any further, if you look at these references to the monetary things, most of you probably hadn't done a lot of detailed study. They're not things that I keep in memory there, but these talents, it's not like you reach in your pocket and you pull out a coin or something. No, this is a huge, heavy weight of solid gold and silver referenced here. A fellow named Walton in a book called Biblical Background says, and I'm borrowing from Michael Whitworth here, expecting him to be dependable. He says that this monetary amount translated into our currency might be $750, but add three more zeros after that. Not $750,000. No, don't stop there. Add three more zeros. $750 million. Hey, I'm cutting you a check in the form of all this. Go, and hopefully this will be enough. If it doesn't cover it, we'll pay the balance. Isn't that incredible? All this stuff. Imagine the entourage of folks keeping social distance, probably from Naaman, that are making their way to Syria with a whole lot of money. An exorbitant amount for any society. The grave misconceptions is, number one, thinking that money was going to pay for it. In 1 Peter chapter 1, 18 and 19, it says that we're not redeemed by corruptible things like silver and gold from the aimless conduct received by tradition by the fathers. What are we as Christians redeemed by? The precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish. You see, the money wasn't what, certainly not Jehoram the king, that's not even the right direction, wasn't what Elisha the prophet was thinking about. I can't pay for my salvation. God's not expecting me to do that. He is expecting me to see the great value paid for it and appreciate the blood of Christ and to appropriate that blood. And so that's where we need to be on that. And so you go to the wrong man in the second place. You think you can buy it for money, not for sale. You go to the king instead of the prophet. Jehoram says, hey, he's seeking a quarrel with me. This is some kind of an underhanded thing. He's very, very shaky about it. And finally, Elisha gets wind of it and says, hey, send him to me. He needs to know that there is a prophet in Israel. Jehoram is all too happy to get him off his hands and say, hey, you do with this guy what you want to. And so Naaman, take up reading with me along about verse 9. Naaman went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan seven times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. If you'll stop right there with me, wouldn't you be glad to hear that? Thought it was a death sentence. No longer a dead man walking. If I do this easy thing, I can keep all the money, by the way, and still go home healed. Not Naaman. Don't be like Naaman, please. Because you read, as he's there at the right place finally, Naaman in verse 11 became furious. He's mad, not just a little bit. And he went away and he said, indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. And then he gets geographical. He says, are not the Abana and the Farfar, the rivers back in Damascus, better than the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? He's not mad. He's not done with it. Some of our anger is just that flash, and we're better when we get the perspective. No, he's still mad. See it? He turned and went away in a rage. You ever think that somehow you figure this thing out in your mind? This is the way it's going to be. There's where Naaman was. He's expecting this grand display. I thought this prophet, and Elisha didn't even give him the dignity of leaving his house. He sent a messenger and said, and go and do that. And so I'm thinking, why isn't he doing this grand display? A lot of people, I guess, maybe are waiting on God to do something marvelous. Show me, Lord, that you want me to be saved. Didn't Jesus come out of the Jordan River? And you've got the Holy Spirit descending like a dove and the voice of the Father. I want some fireworks. I want the show. God usually doesn't act that way, does he? As you look at the grave misconceptions, trying to pay for it, it's not for sale, go to the wrong person. And finally, I'm reasoning in my mind, this is the way it's got to be. He has someone be the voice of reason. In fact, maybe several someones here. Keep reading with me. In 2 Kings chapter 5, in verse 13, his servants came near. What were their names? It doesn't say. Does that mean they're unimportant? Oh, no. They come to him, watch it, with two questions. They're not demanding him. They're not giving orders. They are respectfully asking what I deem to be very good questions. Look at them with me. My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you have not done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? Two questions. In most of our translations, two questions. We need to be people of perspective. Sometimes people have been like the servants to us when we've been out of shape. They've kind of settled us down. Sometimes we are the voice of reason. The folks are a little ruffled and a little perturbed about something. That's the important thing, isn't it? Go to the Jordan River. Can I mention something to you? In my mind, going back to the childhood Bible stories, you know, you go out of Elisha's yard there, maybe over a couple of hills there and through a meadow, and there it is. The Jordan River is about 30 miles away from here. And it's not a direct path. It's not an easy route. Go 30, not feet or yards, go 30 miles away to the muddy Jordan River, and if you'll dip in it seven times, you'll be healed. Was 30 miles away too far? You got a bad case of leprosy and you're dying. Hey, if it's 300, it'll take me a while to get there. Him, probably a day and a half. You make 30 miles, day and a half. And so there's a test of him. Elisha, remember, hasn't even seen Naaman face to face. That'll be later. And then when they ask him, you know what? He's not asking you to do something impossible. God isn't that way. He doesn't ask us something that I can't do or it's not reasonable for me to do. That's true in my obedience to the gospel, and it's true in my discipleship. That important part of what I do after I have become a Christian. God is not expecting the impossible. He's not demanding of us that we do something that no one could possibly do at all. And so, watch him. He went down in verse 14. He went down. I assume that this is referencing geographically. Maybe it's the higher to the lower elevation. But let me say that Naaman had to go down in his humility, swallow the pride, and say, okay, I know they're my servants. I know that this Elisha guy, maybe I'll never meet him, but I'm just going to swallow it and do what he's asked me to do. He humbles himself and then he heeds 30 miles away, probably a day and a half, as we said before. And he dips seven times in the Jordan. Why? Because it is according to the saying of the man of God. I need authority for what I do in my relationship with God, don't you? I don't want to do something because a neighbor or a family member or a friend tells me that's what I need to go to God. And so that's the reason why Naaman did it. Remember the story? Don't want to go and preach another lesson here, but the taking of the walls of Jericho and how you've got this entourage there marching. How many days was it? Seven. How many times did they go around the first 6 days? One. At the end of 6 days, were the walls of Jericho six-sevenths of the way to collapsing? No. On the seventh day, 7 days around. And all these specifications, I want to suggest maybe in a similar way that Naaman, after six times dipping down in the Jordan River, he wasn't nearly healed of his leprosy. I don't think, I can't prove it, I don't think that it was until after the seventh one that his
looks at his flesh and it's like the flesh of a child there. Here is a true test of obedience. Even when you can't reason it out, when it doesn't seem logical, am I going to go with God or not? To Naaman's credit, when he listens to those servants who had his best interests at heart, didn't a good thing happen? Rejoice. Look at how wonderful it is. This glorious miracle. Read it with me one more time. His flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. That's why I left Syria. That's what I came for. And instead of going home to Syria, he returned to the man 30 miles back to Elisha the prophet. Isn't he kind of like the lepers that were healed? Remember, 10 were healed, 9 didn't go back and thank Jesus, 1 did, and that one was a Samaritan and praised because of his appreciation. Naaman couldn't leave without thanking him. It's interesting what he does. He returned to the man of God. He, in all his age, he came and he stood. Watch this beautiful expression of faith in the one true God. Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. Elisha says, still no, not going to take anything. And then Naaman says in verse 17, as I paraphrase, you know what? I like the water of Israel so good. This Jordan has been magic for me. Let me take some of your dirt, too. And he asked for a couple of loads of earth so that he could go back and sacrifice. Now, you really need to read the rest of the story. There's more to it, including Elisha's servant Gehazi that makes a fatal mistake and lays bare a prominent problem for a lot of us in regard to his greed. But up to this point, he's offering a gift to Elisha. Elisha says, no, but go ahead and take the dirt with you. And then Naaman says something like this, my master worships in the temple of the god Rimmon. And when he does that, he's saying, I'm not going to worship, but if it's okay, and when he bows down, then I also bow down with him. And Elisha simply kind of says, do your thing. I don't think he's saying it's okay for you to be idolatrous or anything, but it's almost like Naaman is asking, is that okay? I'm not doing it for that reason. I don't know the rest of this story for Naaman. Really don't. Wouldn't you love to think that he remained monotheistic? He kept believing in the one true God. And maybe he went home and he told that wife and thanked and hugged that little Israelite girl for the tip of getting her in contact with the God that would literally change his life, hopefully his soul. Thinking about our takeaways this evening, time is away from us. I want us to remember that God is the God of all nations. And so people who were the enemy mattered to God. They still do. The Muslim for us. Maybe the one that we wouldn't naturally want to have a conversation or share Jesus with. Maybe we still have some lingering resentment from 9/11. Let me tell you, God cares about them. And this story in part tells us that we need to care for those people as well. They're God's children as well. Number two, affluence is no antidote for afflictions. That is, people in high positions still get sick and die and go bankrupt and all those things. You know what? If I'm one of those people, a lot of us never will be. I need to realize that I'm not immune to those things. None of us are. Neither is the bum on the street. Bad things are going to happen to a lot of people. How we deal with it is so important. And then let's think about this, the value of cleansing. Folks that have gotten over the coronavirus, wouldn't you think they would be so grateful and want to pay it forward and go back and maybe write a generous check to that hospital, that doctor, nurse, if they're in a position to do that? But let me tell you something, simply reminding and preaching the choir, our cleansing from sin is greater than getting over any disease. Amen? We need to value the cleansing, what it cost for you and I to be righteous in the sight of God. That was the death of an innocent man named Jesus. Value the true cleansing, the best cleansing possible. And then think about this, pride goes before destruction.
I am so glad Naaman didn't stay the way he did. Matter of fact, I don't think the story would have been in the Bible had he just said, "Nope, if I can't be washing in the Abana and the Pharpar, forbid that I go to Jordan. I just won't do it." And he'd have simply died in his leprosy right there. I don't want my unholy pride to stand in the way of me and my sure appointment before God. I need to eradicate it. I need to root it out, every vestige of it. There is no room for pride in the heart of a child of God who truly is intent on doing the will of God. And then finally, let's be like the little maid and like the servants of Naaman and simply say, you know what, listen, think about this. Slow down here. I want to be like the maid and say, you know what, there is a healing source you need to know about. And it's not a prophet, but it is the capital P prophet, Jesus Christ. I want to be like the servants that are saying simply, you know what, he's not asking you to do something you can't do. This is not something beyond your capability. Why don't you just wash and be clean? Just ask the questions. Had a church member text me a couple of weeks ago. It was late on a Saturday night. That's not young people late. It's 56-year-old late. You know, 9:30 or something. And he texted me, "Hey, been discussing with some friends here, and they don't think you have to be baptized, and I'm saying you do." But he said, "I feel so ashamed. My dad would have known the scriptures to share. I can't remember them. I can't share. And so could you help me out?" And sure, I gave him a text or two back about you might use this one, take him to this passage. And I saw him a few days later and said, "How'd that go?" "Well, they're still saying, you know, thief on the cross, wasn't baptized, and so they don't think they ought to either." And thinking of that kind of put it home to me. All we're saying to folks is, you know what? I'm grateful for the thieves being in paradise with Jesus. That's not my model. That's not what was taught folks on the day of Pentecost. Why don't I just wash and trust God that if I'll do it His way, I'll be clean without apology, not adding anything to it, not taking anything away from this word, but if I simply trust in God, He'll do what He says He'll do. I wonder if you've done that tonight. Is there someone here of an accountable age who believes in Jesus, knows that He's the Son of God, but has not yet repented of your sins, confessed Christ, and been immersed to have your sins washed away, knowing it's not the water to save you? It's not the water per se, it's how that Jesus prescribed it as a way of contacting His shed blood long ago. Someone out of step with God tonight? Someone needing to come home simply and saying, "I'm sorry, I want to be right. Maybe pride's been my problem or any host of things, but tonight I want to make sure that's right between me and God and my church family." If that is you and you need to make a public response while we stand and sing for your encouragement, won't you come?